Welcome to Just an Average Citizen, the podcast that helps to educate, inform, and empower you to make an impact in Abilene and the Big Country. Welcome back to the second part of the Book by the Bite for the book comic, for the quest for comic justice. So glad you're able to join me today. I hope you enjoyed the first part of this book. I think the second one is equally important, and that's why I broke it up into two sections. If you have enjoyed this podcast, I would love it if you could share this with your family and friends, and make sure to subscribe on whatever platform you choose to listen to. It's important to help get the word out and to help make sure that people can have opportunities for it to show up, because the more you like it, the more you subscribe, then the more those lovely algorithms help promote it to other people as well. So we're going to go ahead and jump right in to the second part of the quest for comic justice. You know, it's crazy to me how books are so powerful and they leave a lasting legacy far beyond what the writers could ever imagine. You know, I can't even imagine some of the writers of days gone by that we still read their books, like the Odyssey or the Iliad, and, you know, like Jane Austen. There's so many books that have such great impact, and, you know, like The Cost of Discipleship by Dietrich Bonhoeffer. Their lives have continued to impact us, and so I love that even though while Thomas Sowell is still alive, his book written in 1999 is impacting us here in 2024. So let's dive into the last two essays that he wrote on the quest for comic justice. If you haven't listened to the first part, I don't think it's so important for you to continue on this podcast, but not, there's a part one to this book. So we're going to look at the tyranny of visions. And I really love the picture that describes, because, you know, visions are powerful unless there's application to it. And unfortunately, what we learned in the first part is that comic justice is not a vision that has any real world application. It's just something to be discussed and causes so many problems because it does not value the cost that it requires in order to enforce it. And just a little recap, though, there are two kinds of justice we're talking about. Traditional justice deals with the process of how things allow for fairness and justice. Is it wrong to use the word in the definition? Whereas cosmic justice is more worried about the vision and the idea of what it can promote, not necessarily worried about how it affects or is the cost. It's about the outcome of justice, whereas traditional justice is about the process of justice. That's probably the succinct way to say it. All right, so this one is really interesting. We start off with a quote from about Lenin and this, about Lenin. So Lenin represented one of the purest examples of a man who operated on the basis of a vision and its categories, which superseded the world of flesh and blood human beings or the realities within which they lived out their lives. Only tactically or strategically did the nature of the world beyond the vision matter as a means to the end of fulfilling that vision. Lenin, Hitler, and Mao were the preeminent 20th century examples of leaders who sought to adjust people to visions, even when that entailed the deaths of millions of human beings. Lenin's preoccupation with visions were demonstrated not only by his failure to enter the world of the working class in whose name he spoke, but also by his failure to ever set foot in Soviet Central Asia, a vast area larger than Western Europe, and one in which the doctrinaire and the devastating schemes of Lenin and his successors would be imposed by force for nearly three quarters of a century. That's crazy to me that this man, who based his ideology on a vision of what the world could be, not reality, a vision, influenced the world, still influences the world today. And we have learned that many of these men, their deathly ideologies killed far more people than religious wars ever did. But do we ever hear that? Nope. We always hear about the death tolls of the religious wars, where we don't realize the secular humanist or the secularist or the fascist or the, you know, the all these men were so destructive and killed so many millions of people. Yet the history has kind of rewritten how they're viewed. And many people look up to people like Mao and Hitler. Maybe not Hitler so much, but definitely Mao. And they don't understand that the government they ran was very unsuccessful. And there's no way to do it because, again, you can't implement visions that have no ability to, as it says, as a means to end of fulfilling that vision. Okay, so let's go here. Believers in this theory acquire no sense of moral superiority, even in their own eyes, though they obviously regard their method of preserving peace as a more effective in practice. However, believers in the opposite theory, disarmament, so we're talking about the theory of peace, you know, the anti-war theory, they don't acquire any sense of moral superiority, but the opposite theory, disarmament, not only regard their own method of preserving peace as more effective, their sense of moral superiority is even apparent when they declare themselves to be anti-war, part of the peace movement, and use the other terms which strongly suggest that the difference between themselves and those with opposite views are due to their being devoted to peace, while others are either warlike or not as committed to peace as themselves, if not venal mouthpieces for the military industries. Oops. Okay, on issue after issue, the morally self-anointed visionaries have for centuries argued if no honest disagreement were possible, as if those who oppose them were not merely in error but sin. This has long been a hallmark of those with the cosmic vision of the world and them of themselves as saviors of the world, whether they're saving it from war, overpopulation, capitalism, genetic degradation, environmental destruction, or whatever the crisis du jour might be. Have we ever heard of any other theories where people want to be the saviors of the world? If you haven't, let's talk, because there's nothing new under the sun. It all repeats itself. Okay, so, I went the wrong way. John Dewey, for example, was opposed to laissez-faire economics and to punitive approach to the criminal, which enables us to ignore our part in creating him. He also caused so many problems in our education system. But anyway, that's beside the point and a story for another day. Bertrand Russell supported the idea of social justice between nations and between individuals, which would require that all ultimate ownership and control of land and raw materials must be in the hands of international authority, for private property in regard to raw materials involves gross justice and powerful incentives to war. Like many others on the political left, he advocated schools in which there is a little discipline as is compatible with the acquisition of knowledge and no corporal punishment whatsoever. In short, pacifism is a part of a coherent vision that extends well beyond the issues of war and peace, while deterrence is part of a very different vision that is also coherent in its larger sweep. Here, as elsewhere, the question is whether which method of avoiding war, in fact, tends to produce desired result, and which turns out to be counterproductive, receives remarkably little empirical examination. From the anointed visionaries, it is the quest for peace, like the quest for cosmic justice, that exalts them morally, irrespective of whether strategy actually reduces the dangers of war, even increases those dangers. Here, as in other expressions of cosmic visions, results are not the test. Taking a moral stand is the test. Did you hear that? You just have to take a moral stand. You're not worried about the outcomes. Just take a stand. As economist Roy Harrod discovered at a 1934 rally of the British Labour Party, a Labour Party candidate proclaimed that Britain ought to disarm, as an example to others, a very common argument at that time. So we're going to go on to this next one. The irrelevant argument that the people of various countries did not want war proved to be as politically indestructible as it was fallacious as an indicator of what governments of those countries were likely to do. Yeah. All right. So down here it says, if a defensive military built up an arms race fails to secure any net advantage whatever against the aggressor, it is nevertheless a huge success if it prevents aggression or the need to surrender. From the standpoint of the non-aggressor nation, it is not trying to gain anything at the expense of anybody else, but simply recognizes the grim reality of the military preparedness is part of the price of maintaining peace, independence, and freedom from what they already have. Okay. Let's see here. In a later era, President Ronald Reagan understood this very clearly when he explained to a horrified group of Washington Post journalists that he intended to win the arm race with the Soviet Union because American resources greatly exceeded those of the USSR, so that the Soviet leaders would ultimately be forced to the bargaining table to begin reducing their threatening nuclear arsenal and scale back their intentional aggressions. To the equal disbelief and disdain of many, he likewise said on more than one occasion that we were seeing the last days of the Soviet Union, which could not take the combined strains of their own counterproductive economic system and foreign military adventures. The fact that the events proved him right has done absolutely nothing to rehabilitate President Ronald Reagan into the eyes of those whom evidence has never been more important than the vision on which their own egos depended. I mean, when you are on a quest for cosmic justice, it doesn't matter what actually happens, your moral stand is way more important. The futility of war is an exhilarating set of sounds rather than a serious statement to be tested seriously against facts. Some wars are indeed futile, some are not. Sweeping a priori pronouncements on the subject serve little purpose other than self-exaltation. At the heart of the spiritual disarmament behind the military disarmament was the cosmic vision of an anointed visionaries. Both the rhetoric and the foreign policy of the British Prime Minister, Neville Chamberlain, reflected virtually every aspect of that vision. First, there was a therapeutic vision of war that if you want to secure a peace which can be relied on to last, you've got to find out that what causes war and remove them. Among these causes were misunderstandings, grievances, differences, and suspicion, and other psychological problems such as enmities and an atmosphere of ill will. Giving these therapeutic visions of the cause of war, Chamberlain incessant repetition of the theme that personal contacts between the head of state were the way to dissipate the psychological malaise and diffuse emotions was perfectly consistent. We now know that Hitler and Mussolini developed contempt for Chamberlain as a result of the Prime Minister's willingness to fly repeatedly to meet with them. They never flew to England to meet with him, even under humiliating conditions, nor was this contempt an incidental sidebar to history. The Axis powers risked war with countries whose military potential they fully understood to be greater than their own because they did not think these countries had the guts to fight or the good sense to build up sufficient military forces in time to fight effectively. As we can see with Paris, they were pacifists. As we can see with France, they were pacifists. They had a military, but they were unwilling to fight until it was too late, and they basically succumbed to Hitler and had to be rescued by the other countries who were willing to join in the battle. Okay, this desperate moment came from Britain and the world, not because the West lacked the material resources to defend itself or because the Axis enemy did not know of the West's superior military potential, but because that potential was allowed to remain mere potential for decades, while the aggressors were visibly, rapidly arming, not only materially, but in spirit, while the West was disarming materially as a result of a disarming spirit. At the end of the war, Churchill looked back and said, "There was never a war in all history easier to prevent by timely action than the one that has just desolated such great areas of the globe." But such timely action to deter war with armaments and military alliance, as Churchill had urged through the 1930s, would not have exalted the anointed visionaries as their champion of opposite policies did. The British, American, and other Allied soldiers who paid with their lives in the early years of the war for quantitatively inadequate and qualitatively obsolete military equipment that's a legacy of the interwar pacifism were among the most tragic of many third parties who have paid the price of other people's exalted visions and self-congratulation. We were unprepared because we thought talking about things would actually make a difference, but actually they just thought they could outwit us even though they weren't as powerful or as strong. They just were ready to fight. And that's what the problem with cosmic justice is it's all about the ideas and not about the actual engagement. It's a moral standpoint, and that's all it is. What does it leave you at the end of the day? With nothing. Like so many things, like if you've been paying attention or stuck with me, postmodernism is the same way. It offers nothing but destruction. Cosmic justice is the same way. There's no way for social justice to produce anything. It's only meant to tear down. And until we understand that anything that is apart from God will produce that outcome, we're going to continue to fall for the same pie-in-the-sky ideologies, visionary things that allow us to feel good while actually proving ourselves to be offering nothing. All right, here we go. The achievement of Lenin's imperialism represents a masterpiece of propaganda cannot be fully appreciated without first understanding the formidable obstacles its author had to overcome in order to rescue Marxian economic theory from more than a half a century of history that contradicted it, and then launch the rescuing theory in the face of masses of additional evidence contradicting Lenin's own doctrine as well. Seriously, the evidence contradicted it, and yet he offered it as well. As someone knowledgeable about confidence games has pointed out, the purpose of the confidence man is not to convince skeptics, but to help others believe what they already want to believe. Displaying the paraphernalia of evidence, embellishment with appropriate rhetoric accomplished that important purpose. Whew. That is so hard. Let's see here. I guess I kept that one. From the standpoint of logic, evidence differs from mere fact in that evidence consists of wax more consistent with one theory than another. Therefore, the appropriate criterion for evidence is not simply whether it's factually accurate, but whether it's logically relevant to make that discrimination. Parading statistics which document to the hilt the things that are not an issue, that capitalist industry was growing greatly, that the banks had huge deposit, for example, is logically vacuous. Nevertheless, it can and did succeed as propaganda designed to create an atmosphere of great knowledge about esoteric things that presumably sinister and their presumably sinister inner meanings. The idea that the non-industrial world offered safety valve outlet for the surplus capital of the industrial world cannot stand up if the industrial nations are investing primarily in each other. This would be adding to the economic and social pressures rather than relieving them if the Marxian theory of excess capital accumulation were correct. The utter failure of Lenin's imperialism as a work of logic only highlights its success as propaganda. To convince people of the truth of something that is true by logical inference from evidence requires no talent whatever in the arts of propaganda, but to convince many highly educated people around the world that a theory that is demonstrably false by the use of hard data artfully presented is a clear triumph of propaganda and makes Lenin imperialism one of the great classics of that art. And my journey has taken me to the place where how do I engage with people who are believing in demonstrably false narratives? Because it is so sad to me that people are blind to what is right in front of their face. But because we have been conditioned to believe and trust people in certain positions of power, it makes us turn off our brains so that we don't know how to engage with people. And that's why I think this is so important to understand that we can't bring facts to the table to convince people to believe something different. We have to address the heart of what it is. What's this vision? What is this ideology that allows you to stand and do nothing? What is the result? What are the fruits of this? You know, to help people work through this conversation is how you begin to open their eyes. It's not by producing new facts and new figures, because clearly if they're believing something that's demonstrably false, facts and figures are not what their heart is. Their heart is wrapped around this idea of cosmic justice, which is never, you cannot realize it in this world because of how our world operates. And I'm just trying to discover how do we engage and have these conversations that start to bring the fissures that will eventually crumble these ideologies that we have propped up to be so valuable and worthwhile when they're just in the antithesis to who God is and what he stands for and what his kingdom is all about. Okay, let's go here to this next one. In short, many people are making choices and trade-offs, however appalling those choices might seem to observers. Okay, so here's the thing. I'm sorry, sometimes I can forget what I'm talking about until I read the quote. So what this is it's actually talking about when in the 19th century or the early 20th century, where people were living in such deplorable conditions where they were having to go to outhouses in the cold, or they didn't have toilets, it was just not really a really ideal conditions. And so people of the cosmic justice world thought, oh my gosh, this is terrible. We've got to fix this. And I guess they weren't cosmic justice people because that term wasn't around then, but they were like, this is terrible. We got to fix these people's worlds. They're living in such deplorable conditions. We're going to maintain a standard. We're going to create laws that maintain a standard of housing, so these landlords cannot get away with these slums that they're allowing these people to live in. And here's this interesting quote that I think is important for us to understand. When we don't worry about the results of our ideology and our moral stance, what consequences come from not counting the cost? In short, people are making choices and trade-offs, however appalling those choices might seem to observers, and how unfair it might be that their choices had to be made in the first place when so many others had so many better options available to them. The kind of reforms being promoted in the 19th century did not expand the slum dwellers' options, but reduced them. Since better housing mandated by law costs more money, immigrant slum dwellers now had to devote a higher percentage of their incomes towards purchasing more expensive housing with features that would be more pleasing to third-party observers, rather than make trade-offs that they themselves would have preferred with their own money. In short, people were making choices and trade-offs. When one considers the dire poverty and dangers to life and limb from mobs that Jews were facing in Eastern Europe at the time, the desires of Jews on the Lower East Side of New York to get their loved ones fed and have them brought and then brought over to America clearly had urgency, however much of the fact might be unknown or ignored by housing reformers. Nor was the desire to save for a better future for their children merely a forlorn hope, as a later rise of the Jews in the United States showed. Reformers who reacted to the slums before their eyes and to their own sense of social injustice had nothing to force them to face the trade-offs inescapably faced by people living in those slums. Even the fact that slum dwellers often joined with the slum landlords to physically resist being evicted by those authorities from housing declared substandard did not cause Jacob Riis or many other reformers to reconsider whether they were doing was really in the best interest of the people whose interests they were ostensibly protecting. It is all too easy for people with more formal schooling to believe they know better than those directly concerned. The underlying problem was the poverty of the people living in the slums. Their housing was only a symptom of that problem. Indeed, one of the ways of minimizing the effect of their poverty by leaving more money to meet their needs for food, for help to relatives abroad, and to prepare their children to rise in American society. Housing reform added nothing to these people's meager incomes. On the contrary, it commandeered some of those meager resources to make the third party feel better. Like so much done in that quest for cosmic justice, it makes observers feel better about themselves and provides no incentives for those observers to scrutinize the consequences of their actions to the ostensible beneficiaries. As in other cases, human beings are sacrificed to the tyranny of visions because those sacrificed are not the same as those exhilarated by the vision. All right, so we're going to wrap up this summary. Let's see, we're at... Much of the history of the 20th century has been a history of the tyranny of visions as dogmas. Previous centuries saw the despotisms of monarchs or military conquerors, but the 20th century has seen the rise of the ruling individuals and parties whose passport to power was their successful marketing of visions. Almost by definition, this was not the marketing of the promises of visions, since performances could not be judged before achieving the power to put the visions into action. Oh, I was supposed to read that. Sorry. The prevalence and power of a vision is shown not by what evidence or logic can prove, but precisely by its exemption from any need to provide evidence or logic by the number of things that can be successfully asserted because they fit the vision without having to meet the test of fitting the facts. Okay, last one on this one. Okay, let's see. Among the perennial popular notions for which evidence is neither asked nor given, most prove to be very self-flattering to those who believe them. For example, it was many years a popular staple among American liberals that the Roosevelt New Deal saved capitalism in spite of itself, that is, in spite of the capitalists who opposed FDR and his programs. In other words, the stupid or short-sighted businesses were going to destroy themselves if it had not been for the far-sighted liberals in Washington who saved them and their economic system that made their success possible. Okay. Let's see here. I think that is it for that essay. Yeah, I think so. Okay. Well, we're going to go on to the next one anyway, because if not, we're just moving on. All right. So this last one, of course, as a American history buff, I love the American history. I still have barely even scratched the surface of it. And I just am so thankful for people who guide us to know the great places to look for original source documents, understand what our founders thought, wanted, and tried to implement rather than the narrative that's being shoved down our throats through our education system and all that stuff. So this one's called this essay is The Quiet Repeal of the American Revolution. So let's start off here. The Revolutionary War for American independence was not simply a landmark event in the history of the United States. It was a landmark event in the history of the world, and especially a landmark in the history of the evolution of free and democratic societies. Its intentional significance was symbolized by France's donation of the Statue of Liberty to the United States on the 100th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence and by the creation of a facsimile of the statue in China more than a century after that by protesters vainly seeking to create a free and democratic government in that country. The American Revolution, however, went further in rejecting a basic conception of man and society that goes back thousands of years and which is still with us today. Down through the centuries, people of the most diverse philosophic persuasions have proceeded as if what was needed to replace false doctrines with true doctrines and false leaders with true leaders, the heathens with the faithful, capitalists with the socialists, royalty with republicans, and so on. But unlike the French Revolution or the Bolshevik Revolution, for example, the American Revolution and its resulting constitution did not center on the change in the cast of characters in high places or in charge of their political language or immediately policy agenda. Its central concern was establishing new processes by which whoever occupied the places of powers could be restrained and replaced. In short, it did not pretend to have a doctrinal truth, but instead implied a deep skepticism that anyone had either a monopoly on doctrinal truth or such moral or intellectual rectitude as to be an example exempt from constraints, condemnations, or dismissals from office by their fellow men. So, you know, it gave the common man a voice of veto, elbow room, and refuge from the rampaging presumption of his betters. So this is why we have to oppose those with more ambitious visions, even if they do not consciously feel any animosity towards constitutional freedoms. Okay. We've got to be careful because people don't come in necessarily for bad. They don't think they're doing anything bad. They're trying to do something better. And they don't realize what they're destroying in the process. Okay? That some leader dangerous to the basic intentions of American society could rise, Lincoln thought inevitable. Safeguarding those institutions would require publicly sufficiently united, sufficiently attached to freedom, and sufficiently wise to successfully frustrate his designs. Today would also require a public sufficiently resistant to incessant criticisms and condemnations of their society for failing to achieve cosmic justice. Moreover, if the dangers in our own time were limited to the towering genius, there would be much less danger than there is. However, all that is needed are towering presumptions, which are increasingly mass-produced in our schools and colleges by the educational vogue of encouraging immature and inexperienced students to sit in emotional judgment on the complex evolution of whole ages and vast civilizations. Let's see here. Political leaders are not the only ones with a vested interest in opposing the existing framework of American society, precisely because it's the existing framework so that the supporting it offers no path to the kind of glory they seek. The intelligentsia have exactly the same incentives as the Napoleonic politicians, even if their glory they seek is not necessarily direct political power in their own hands, but the triumph of their doctrines, the reordering of other people's lives in accordance with their visions, a display of their own intellectual veracity, or simple a posture of daring in the role of a verbal dandy. The easiest way to achieve all these goals is to disdain the beaten path, as Lincoln put it, and to attack or undermine the fundamental structure of American political system and society. In this formulation, common among the intelligentsia, people are in jail because they cannot function in the society. It is not that they do not choose to function, but they prey on others instead and to commit the acts that are crimes in all sorts of societies around the world. Unfortunately, what many call society, in fact, is civilization. No one openly and opposed to American civilization, nor even covertly plotting a surmise, many of these pursuing a vision of cosmic justice simply take advantage adversarial position against traditions, morals, institutions that make survival of the civilization possible. So it seems to me that cosmic justice fits very nicely in with postmodernism. And if you haven't listened to the postmodernism discussion, we talked about that when discussing Dr. Grossman's book, Lost in Transnation. And I believe that was part one. If you want to go back and catch up in case you didn't. The vision is the vision of cosmic justice. In addition to its other dangers, the quest for cosmic justice is incompatible with the fundamental principles of the American Revolution, the rule of law, individual freedom, and democratic government. The rule of law, a government of laws and not of men, implies rules known in advance, applied generally, and constraining the rulers as well as the ruled. Freedom implies exemptions from the power of the rulers and corresponding limitations on the scope of all laws, even those of democratically elected governments. Congress shall make no law. The First Amendment to the Constitution of the United States began spelling out some of the exemptions from laws which constitute the right to freedom. Democracy implies majority sanction as the basis for laws, but democracy by itself implies nothing about freedom or the rule of law. A majority may destroy the freedom of a minority or make the issue of edicts as arbitrary and discriminatory as it wishes. The systematic denial of rights to American blacks in the Southern states during Jim Crow era was a classic example of democratic despotism. Rules equally applicable to all are not the same rules as rules with equal impact on all. The law in its majestic equality forbids the rich as well as the poor to sleep under bridges, to beg in the streets and steal bread. In today's American legal doctrine, this is called disparate impact. Many public and private acts and policies with disparate impacts on different segments of population are banned as discriminatory, even when these acts and policies apply to the same procedures and standards to everyone. However, an understanding that equal rule does not mean equal consequences goes much further back in history than 1971 doctrine of disparate impact or Anatole France's remark in 1874. Nor was this understanding confined to the political left. In his scathing reflections of the revolution in France, Edmund Burke said, "All men have equal rights, but not to equal things. In short, inherent conflict between equal rules and equal results have been recognized in theory for at least two centuries, even though many of our contemporaries proclaim as if it were some new discovery or deeper inside of theirs that these laws are formally equal may affect different groups differently." All right. They conclude that real equity must supersede mere formal equality. I'm sorry, I said equity. They conclude that real equality must supersede mere formal equality, which is to say that cosmic justice must trump traditional justice. A common expression of this view is that equality before the law without economic, political, and social opportunity is mockery. What is crucial at this point is not whether we agree or disagree with one another of those conceptions, but that we clearly understand they are mutually incompatible and their fundamental contradictions cannot be blended or finessed. The difference between the equal treatment of traditional justice and equal result of equal prospects of cosmic justice affect many kinds of issues. From the perspective of those who seek cosmic justice, freedom of speech does not merely mean simply expressing oneself. It doesn't mean you got to be able to say it in a way that doesn't offend other people. All right. Let's see here. We are at all this changes. Okay, here we go. All this changes radically, however, within the framework of cosmic justice. If some group is not receiving justice, then whether this is due to governmental or private actions is seen as secondary, if it's relevant at all. Nowhere has this been more acutely felt than in issues involving racial discrimination. Here it is often insisted that everyone is entitled to equal treatment and that also each group must advocate and insist upon the piece of the pie and that there has been a failure of the private sector to address the issue forthrightly. Constitutional rights are essentially exemptions from government power under traditional concepts of justice becomes reasons for further extensions of government power under cosmic concepts of justice. Cosmic justice cannot be achieved with a government of laws and not of men, and simply establishes a legal framework with which individuals are free to make their own decisions and arrange their own voluntary transactions on whatever terms are mutually agreeable. For cosmic justice, someone must oversee the social results of these individuals' transactions and intervene directly to ensure the desired social results or prospects are arranged. Wow. Moreover, while traditional justice concerns rules of interaction between flesh and blood human being, cosmic justice concerns abstract categories, okay? And they're adjusted to the face of the third parties. So again, it's all about their ideas. They decide what is good. It's inherent in the process of seeking cosmic justice since general rules can produce only indiscriminate results, not equal results or results fitting some preconceived notions of diversities. These edicts do not happen to be vague. They are necessarily vague. They could not be otherwise. So vague allows you to wiggle your way in and out of what is going on. In summary, cosmic justice attempts to create equal results or equal prospects with little or no regard for whether the individual or groups involved are in equal circumstances or have equal capabilities or equal personal drives. To do this, it cannot operate under general rules, the essence of law, but must create categories of people entitled to various outcomes regardless of their inputs. Moreover, it does this sub rosa by creating huge burdens of proof for any criteria that reveal the inequalities and capabilities and circumstances while assuming with little or no evidence they only malign intentions or systemic bias could explain unequal results. Affirmative action is perhaps the classic example of this approach, but it is only one example. Man, I remember thinking, realizing affirmative action is just reverse discrimination. And it was like so shocking because it's like we had undone everything. And why are we allowing it to go the other way? You know, it's wrong either way. But the problem is back to that idea of we've got to give people a chance since they've not had a chance. It doesn't affect the people who are dead. It affects the people who are living and suffering because of those third party influences on the way world is going. All right, let's see here. Let's see. Okay. Yeah, let's go this next one here. All right. With a cosmic concept of bias or advantage, people seeking or justifying preferential policies often speak of such policy as being necessary to create a level playing field. However, this phrase has a wholly different meaning outside the framework of cosmic justice. In traditional terms, what preferential policies create is a playing field titling in favor of those whose performance on the level playing field would be inadequate. The point here is not to assess the particular merits of a particular preferential policy or of preferential policies in general, which has been done elsewhere, but to demonstrate the diametrically opposite meaning of the same phrase when used inside and outside the framework of cosmic justice. Among the first rights to be sacrificed in the quest for cosmic justice are property rights. I thought this was so good. A free market economy is much dependent on property rights as a political system is on free speech rights. The easiest way to see the effects of property rights is see what happens in their absence or curtailment. Government abolition of private property and agricultural land has created food shortages in countries around the world, among people of every race and in political systems of many sorts, even in countries that were once exporters of food from Eastern Europe or Sub-Saharan Africa. So food has in many places and in various periods of history been a special target of price controls, often on plausible sounding ground that food is so basic a need that poor must be assured access to it at a price they can afford. Yet all too often, mass hunger has followed the wake of price controls on food, whether during the era of the French Revolution in modern African nations or in Asia. Housing shortages have followed rent control, whether in New York City, Paris, Hong Kong, Melbourne, Stockholm, or other places. Price controls on medical treatment have led to long waiting lines in doctor offices and long waiting lists for operations, whether in China, Europe, or elsewhere. For Americans, at least the matter was settled long ago when the Constitution declared no person can be deprived of life, liberty, property without due process of law, nor shall private property be taken for public use without just compensation. By the second half of the 20th century, however, all this was being eroded rapidly by judges. Moreover, the erosion and undermining of property rights was applauded in leading law schools and by intelligentsia in general. The traditional conception of role of judges was expressed 1,000 years ago by Aristotle, who said that judge should be allowed to decide as few things as possible. His discretion should be limited to such points as the lawgiver has not already defined for him. Moreover, the law itself must be application of roles, be used for the guidance of others besides litigants for his decisions as not particular but prospective in general. A judge cannot do justice directly in the cases before him, is how cosmic justice people see it. He was saying it was not the judge's function to put it there, that this was a legislative function. Much of the same view later was echoed by Judge Robert H. Bork when he said justice is for the Congress and the president to administer, and if they see fit, through the creation of new law. That was something that was kind of new to me, to think that judges don't distribute justice. It has come through the legislative function. Isn't that interesting? And that makes you go, I need to think about that. On the contrary, however, the separation of roles in creating law is crucial to the preservation of the rule of law itself. Legislative encroachments, presidential actions, and amendments to the Constitution are all things which publicly announce changes in the law of the land, providing foreknowledge of changes in the legal framework with which free people may act and plan. Moreover, all these processes are ultimately responsible to people themselves and can be reversed if the people find them onerous. And I think it's interesting to point out here that our government was set up in a way to not be quick to move. Like, we don't change with the tides and the seasons. We have to go through a process so that when it gets to the end, it is a legitimate something that has changed is legitimate enough to make sure that it was worth changing. So like, you know, for example, with CRT, we can't really change CRT fast enough because in the laws, I mean, we're trying to do it, but it's really pointless because CRT evolves into, you know, it was a critical race theories. Now it's diversity, equity, inclusion. And now it's moving into multiculturalism. There's no stop to the end of what is going on. So we can't change the laws to catch up with it. We have to do stuff that is more substantial. And I used to get frustrated when things wouldn't change slowly. Like, you know, I've been working with trying to get some bad books removed, some inappropriate books for children moved to a more appropriate section in the library. And it's taken over a year. I mean, we're still not anywhere close to it. And I've had to pause and think how to best attack this problem. But that's the way it's supposed to be. It's not supposed to be something that's rash and done quickly. It's supposed to be, if we make changes, it should be because it's worth making the change. And so many people fall by the wayside, but courts have been very instrumental in changing things without making legislative changes. And that's problematic. And I really appreciate his input on that topic here. Okay, so the difference between cosmic justice and traditional justice means a huge difference in the power of judges. Under the cosmic justice, the judge's role is to decide whether the behavior of each of the parties fits the judge's notions of what they should have done. Under traditional justice, the judge decides the much narrower question as to what each party has a right to do at the party's own discretion under existing laws and agreements. Cosmic justice not only makes judge roving second guessers, but surrounds prospective agreements with a penumbra of uncertainty, making such agreements harder to reach and carry out. The quest for cosmic justice via the judiciary law as an agent of change is often phrased quietly repeals one of the foundations of the American Revolution. It reduces free people to a subject people, subject now to the edicts of unelected judges enforcing evolving standards that are made more heedless by their exalted sense of moral superiority. It is one of the most dangerous of many ways in which towering presumptions are a threat to the freedom of Americans, which is why exactly it was so problematic when we just passed the Sanctuary City for the Unborn Act. The council didn't want to do anything with it. And no, they're not judges, but they were like, we don't want to decide anything. We don't even discuss anything. We want the people to vote on it. We're going to send it to the voters. And then the voters elected it. Passed it. We said, yes, we want the ordinance. The city of Abilene wants this ordinance. It was passed. And then once the new council came on, they said, well, you know, they didn't know what they were doing. We're going to fix it for them. And it's like, what the heck? You didn't want to have a role in it. You didn't want to have any input in it. And then you tell us we don't understand it. That's not your role. And while I'm glad that things worked out the way they should, that is scary to me that they can decide what we do or don't know and then use the legal aspect of what they're allowed to do in their powers. Because unfortunately, most ordinances they're not addressing citizen initiative petition ordinances that are passed. And so the ordinance is allowed to be changed. And that's what the charter said. But it's like they were using their moral superiority to tell us what we should or shouldn't do when we clearly were given that place by them and then they took it back. And it's crazy to me how those things work. But I'm learning a lot and understanding how to stand up to that kind of stuff better in the future. The first field in which the burden of proof began to shift in the defendant or respondent was the antitrust law. The most sweeping and dramatic shift was in civil rights law, which followed by similar developments in environmental laws, tort liability, sexual harassment policies, and laws and policies applied to families. In those areas, what was being sought was cosmic justice for some, with the usual disregard of the cost of this for others. Environmental, oh my gosh, that is totally cosmic justice, because the cost, I was driving through West Texas the last few days, and it's like seeing all those wind farms and knowing how disaster it is to the land that they're sitting on. And, you know, people are talking about how bad fossil fuels are, but these wind farms do not do what they say they're supposed to do. They don't produce the energy. They're destructive. They're ugly. They take up so much room, and they're not, they sit in landfills for, I don't know how many decades. It is such a crock that we bought into because we wanted to do the right thing. The cosmic justice said, do the right thing. But traditional justice says, what about the process? Oh, we don't know the cost. It's going to work itself out. It's not. And all those people who allowed it on their property were probably paid by the federal government to do it. And it's hard to turn away money when you don't really know the cost of what it's really costing us overall. I don't fault them, but at the same time, I feel stupid because we were duped by them, right? All right. Freedom, however, has long been defined in radically different ways by those with different visions, and especially by those in the quest of cosmic justice. The traditional concept of freedom as exemption from power has already been illustrated by such language in the Constitution's Bill of Rights as Congress shall make no law. Note that the possible merits of these laws is not at issue. When it comes to freedom of religion or the press, for example, Congress shall make no law. Exemption from any laws that Congress might want to make is, in effect, the definition of these freedom. By implication, power is the ability to restrict people's opinions, and freedom is an exemption from having one's option restricted in such matters as religion or the expression of ideas. All this changes, however, with the framework of cosmic justice, where freedom and power are conceived in entirely different terms. Among the many their power may be defined as the capacity of an individual to modify the conduct of other individuals when he desires to prevent his own conduct from being modified in a manner which he does not. It sounds really awesome. Nothing has been more common in countries around the world over the centuries of history for a fraction of the participants in any given activity to produce a disproportionate amount of activity. Yet nothing has been more common among intellectuals than to regard such disproportionalities as usual, if not sinister. In other words, the federal government may do what is specifically authorized to do, while the people or the individual states may do whatever they're not specifically forbidden to do. And they've been doing stuff they're not supposed to do, and we haven't said, wait a minute, give that back. That's not your power. You're doing stuff you're not supposed to do because we're ignorant, because we've been stuck reading fictional books all the time and enjoying ourselves rather than reading original source documents. So thanks for those of you who are still listening. Stick to the original source documents. Let's get back, get our federal government back in its box, because it has been letting go willy-nilly for far too long. Okay. No institution has been more traditionally one of the local control than the public schools. Yet the growing scope of federal subsidy and control, particularly through the Department of Education, has successfully removed more and more decisions from the parents and voters in local districts, transferring those decisions to Washington. It simply does not matter whether the parents, voters, or local officials are up in arms against whole language, methods of teaching, reading, or promotion of avant-garde sexual attitudes in schools. If these ideas are vogue among those in Washington who control the purse strings, it doesn't matter if Hispanic parents want their children to be taught in the English language, if federal bureaucrats favor so-called bilingual programs in which most courses are taught in Spanish. It doesn't matter if local schools want to maintain a tighter discipline, if federal guidelines make it impossible to ride a tight ship. So here's the problem. The government gives you money. You take the money because you need it, because you're running a tight ship. And then they're like, okay, now we control you. And that's the problem. We have, you know, nonprofits in town accepting government money, federal grants. And I understand that there is some benefit to that, but we've got to start recognizing the strings may not be worth the money that it's attached to. And we have to be careful, because schools are a perfect example of that. We have no control locally because they all have to bind all the money. They've been given money, so they have to mind their P's and Q's and do what's being said. And it's really created a terrible, ineffective system of schooling that our children are suffering from. Despite the numerous studies showing that the amount of money spent per pupil has little or no effect on the quality of education, federal officials are constantly pushing for an expansion of federal aid to education in the guise of investing in children's future. However little effect this money will have on the quality of these children's education, it has enormous effect on the expansion of federal power. This money may not buy better education for students, but unquestionably buys up the freedom of parents, voters, and local authorities, and transfers decision-making power to Washington. As many have warned in the past, freedom is unlikely to be lost all at once and openly. It is far more likely to be eroded away bit by bit amid glittering promises and expansion of noble ideas. Man, noble ideas get us every time. We want to do good things, but the problem is there's no follow-through with those good things. They're just ideas to open the door, to get in, and take away our freedom. Thus, hard-earned freedoms for which many have fought and died for have now been bought and sold for words or money or both. That in turn means the quiet and piecemeal repeal of the American Revolution and the freedom that signified as ideal for everyone. Such moral and intellectual arrogance is the fundamental and irreconcilable conflict with American creed of the common man. Someone once referred the masses of the immigrant coming to Americans as the beaten men of beaten races. In one sense, he was right, but in a deeper sense, history has proven him profoundly wrong. From its colonial beginnings, American society was decapitated society, largely lacking the topmost social layers of European society. The highest elites and the titled aristocrats had little reason to risk their lives crossing the Atlantic and then face the perils of pioneering. Most of the white population of colonial America arrived as indentured servants and the black population as slaves. Did you know about that? Did you know that most of us arrived with nothing because we wanted something better? The rise of American society, preeminence as an economic, political, and military power in the world, was thus the triumph of the common man and a slap across the face to the presumptions of the arrogant, whether an elite of blood or of books. All right, so that finishes up our book. I am really happy about finishing it. It was a good book. I reread it in order to prepare for this, so I'm happy to do that. I try to do that to refresh my memory, but every book I offer is something I would read again and would love to read and talk with you about, but sometimes our lives don't allow for that. So thanks so much for joining for the second part of this episode of The Cosmic Quest for Justice. I look forward to the next book we're going to take a bite out of, and maybe I can keep it short, but you know me, I really like to talk about things and chew them over and really expose so much of what is going on in our culture for what it is. So if you've enjoyed this podcast, please feel free to subscribe and share it with your families and friends. We're always looking for ways to promote this so that we can get more information out to the public about what's going on in our world and how it applies to what we do for life here in Abilene in the big country. So thank you so much for watching. I look forward to our next time together. And until then, have a great day.